Julie Jones Baker and Patrick Jones, the music this morning. I thought as I looked over there that we had Beauty and the Beloved Maestro. Thank you both. Life shows its usual mix of good and bad news this morning. The sad news you have already heard, that our beloved Margene Nye Hubbs married just last February, our coffee lady for so many years, particularly when we were downtown, died suddenly of a heart attack, and her funeral was held here yesterday. The glad news is that we can welcome home Ernie and Bertie Crow this morning. They have just returned from having celebrated their 50th wedding anniversary in Colorado. And we welcome a great many others who are back after summer. Church reminds me a little of college. Long about the end of August, everybody comes back. It's nice to see your faces. Speaking of college, during the years she was in Wichita, some of you may have met a colleague of mine in the English department named Andrea Gowdy. If I remember right, Andrea had been exposed as a baby to a light that was too bright. It may have been sunlight. At a time when she couldn't protect herself. And because of that one tragic moment of neglect, she had spent her whole life in darkness. I was admiring one day her determination and courage in pursuing an advanced degree in English, using Braille for the heavy load of readings. And I said something about her working with the faculty every day with no idea about our appearance. The good friend replied to me, "Oh, she knows how you look." She meant that Andrea had formed a mental image of us from our walk and our voices, the things we said in faculty meetings, had probably seen more deeply into the true essence of each one of us than most other people who glanced at us in the hallways or while we stood up before a class, noticed whether we had on the right tie. This paradox about those who have eyes and cannot see and those who are blind but see more deeply into certain realities than all the rest of us is an old, old theme in literature. You remember the blind prophet, Tiresias, in the Greek plays? They called him a seer. He could not look, but he could see. And even kings wanted the benefit of his unique sight. I remember some moments by myself on mountaintops in Idaho and Colorado when if somebody had walked up and said, "What are you seeing?" I might have said that I was seeing God about as well as I had ever been able to manage it. And I would have hoped that the one who asked would have enough poetry in his soul to know what I meant. That spread out before me was the artistry of creation. That in all that buckling and upheaval of millions of millenniums, I felt the awesome presence of mystery that was beyond the brief little sputter of my life to comprehend. So why not give the old Jewish prophet Isaiah credit for the same kind of poetic vision when he says in that reading you heard a few minutes ago, that very strange reading, that he saw the Lord seated on a throne, high and lifted up, with the skirt of his robe filling the temple, with those strange creatures called seraphim, with their six wings, straight out of Babylonian mythology, shouting nonstop praise, holy, 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 while the whole place shook and trembled like 8.1 on the Richter scale, and the house filled up with smoke. It's clearly the stuff of poetry. Forget the literalism that is so often the curse of the Western mind. This is not a news story. There's no point in saying, gee, I wish I could have taken a picture of that, because the picture exists in Isaiah's head and heart. He is describing poetically his call to preach, a vision he saw not with the optic nerves, but the dreaming heart, an image of the power and majesty of God that would sustain him on those days when his preaching fell on deaf ears. In one way or another, everyone who speaks from a pulpit has had some kind of vision that lies deeper than the retina. And in one way or another, every sermon I preach, I am forever asking myself and you to cultivate the same kind of deeper sight, to consider life lived on the far side of objective, journalistic, Western rational thought. Because despite the protests of old Sergeant Webb on that classic TV series called Dragnet, what people of the Christian faith are interested in is more than just the facts, ma'am. The facts may be that you make so much money, that you like Chrysler cars, that you practice law or construction work, that you live at a certain address, that you have this favorite sport and that favorite vacation spot, all verifiable, all with some importance, yet all combined, not enough to reveal the whole truth about you, or even the most important truth. Because there is another world inside, a world of subjective reality. That world in which you wake up at night, who hasn't done it, and consider what you are that no one else knows about. The secret world of your fondest hopes and deepest fears, that whole invisible universe of you that only the imagination of another person can even begin to see. Surely you know what I mean when I say that we look at most people, but we see only a few. Isaiah, in that bizarre experience, was not literally looking at God. God, we are told elsewhere, doesn't live in temples anyway. And seraphim have about as much scientific reality as the satyrs and sirens of Greek religion. And all that smoke and rattling of the rafters doesn't mean much to those of us who were met in this room on the last Sunday of August in the year of our Lord 1933. 93. I knew nothing about 33. Nothing about it at all, except as the outpouring of Isaiah's dream sight, dream vision, that strange and wonderful result of having seen the world, listen, for an instant, as both spiritual and luminescent. As the words of my sermon title say, we have to do what he did. We have to learn to see, not just look. And this is one of those places, right here, where we practice using the eyes of the heart. I go to a Dr. Relihan to see how my optic nerves are functioning. He comes to places like this to see whether the vision of his heart is still keen and clear. Always two ways to see the world. Shakespeare says it marvelously in King Lear. When the old monarch forgets one day that his companion is physically blind and cries out, "You see how this world goes?" To which the blinded Gloucester responds, "I see it feelingly." Some people with 20/20 vision never see anything feelingly. After you list all the other reasons why people shoot and stab one another without remorse, write down this one: that they are able to do it because they do not see anyone inside, not even themselves. They never learned how to put themselves inside the skin of their victim. They can't see the paraplegic they will leave behind to face the hopeless years. They can't see the ruin of a family, the heartbreak of a wife, the tears of a child. They only look and see a shape, and without empathy or even a wink of insight, they might just as well be doing violence to a block of wood. So where is it developed? This sympathetic imagination, this learning to see, not just look. Reading helps. Oh, how it helps, if the books are good. School helps, if one stays there. Churches can help, if they don't get so caught up in doctrinal trivia that the heart slowly freezes instead of thawing. I can hardly believe sometimes the burden of some preaching. Shall we sing only with our vocal cords, or will God hear a piano? Shall we dip the convert all the way under the water, or will it serve to touch the bowed head with damp fingers? Is communion required weekly, or will twice a year be enough? All the minutiae of legalism, when surely the ultimate test of a Christian is whether or not he or she sees the world as Christ saw it, feelingly. Sermons ought to teach us in 100 different ways, not just to look at the world, but to see it. I realize that if I'm out on a walk in an Amazonian rainforest, I'd better be ready to make some quick judgments about whether the snake dangling from the limb just ahead of me is a mamba or a harmless tree snake. I also realize that if I walk in the urban jungle, I may have time only to look and not to see before I turn away from the three boys who are walking my way. But what a pity when fear forces us to dehumanize one another like that. I shudder sometimes to think what it would be like to be a young black man and know that no matter how decent I am, what I will get on any street corner will be the quick and worried look that cannot afford to see any deeper than my skin. Do you ever try to imagine how terrible that would be? I'm not so foolishly romantic as to think it can be different overnight. I read the paper and watch TV. I tense up on that street the same as you. But what a pity. In fact, it's hard enough for me even to see people, really see people in my own little subculture. I mean really see the luminescence that runs like an invisible river just beneath the surface. If we saw it all the time, I think it would probably blind us. But if we never see it, we simply do not know the meaning of religion. The mistake we make is thinking that this kind of deeper sight has to be some sort of ecstatic experience happening in a monastery or on a Swiss mountain. It can happen in the kitchen or at school or while you walk the halls of a hospital. The church really knew something back in the first century when it called every member a saint. Not that any of them were perfect, but that each one, under the surface flaws, had a potential waiting to be called into fulfillment. I said earlier that we look at a great many people in a lifetime. We see only a few. You'll remember, some of you, a quotation from a play that I shared with you years ago. I happen to think it's one of the great moments in American fiction. The play is called The Rainmaker, and a girl named Lizzie is talking about her father to a young man named Starbuck. Listen and ask yourself if this has ever happened to you. Some nights, she says, I'm in the kitchen washing dishes, and Pop's playing poker with the boys. Well, I'll watch him real close. And at first, I'll just see an ordinary middle-aged man, not very interesting to look at. And then minute by minute, I'll see little things I never saw before. Good things and bad things I never paid any mind to. And suddenly, I know who he is. And I love him so much, I could cry. And I want to thank God I took the time to see him real. That line captures the whole sermon. The time to see him real. Something is missing for you if you never had that moment with a friend, a husband, or a wife, a child, a sweetheart. Looking not just the way a camera looks, especially in the hands of one who is not an artist, but seeing with the eyes of the mind and the heart. A grand old Baptist preacher named Will Camel was trying to make that point when he described in one of his books an incident involving his brother. The two of them were walking in the woods near the family farm, and they heard a noise from behind a bush. They pulled back the branches, and there in a small clearing was Will's nephew, a boy about the age of my wonderful grandson, Tanner, who's listening up there in the balcony. That little boy was kneeling beside the spot where only the day before the family had buried a beloved old dog. The young boy had made a rough cross out of a couple of sticks, and he was kneeling by the fresh mound of dirt, his head bowed in prayer. "Look at that," Will said. And his brother, a camera buff, raised his new Nikon state-of-the-art 35-millimeter technological wonder and looked through the viewfinder for a moment, and then he put it down without clicking the shutter and whispered quietly, "Some things you just can't photograph." Well, you could, of course, and the picture would be touching, but the camera would not have seen all they saw in that moment. In my neighborhood, there is a strong, handsome black man who is terribly and distractingly handicapped. Sometimes I only look at him. I register what a camera would register. Sometimes I open the eyes of the heart and actually see him, which means simply that I enter through sympathetic vision his mind and try to feel what it must be like to spend a lifetime walking around the world the way he has to. Tell me what you see, and I'll know more about what you believe than if you talk to me for hours about doctrine. When you see with imagination, what you see with that amazing gift changes your whole life. I read the other day about a teacher of Greek culture, a doctor of philosophy, and a remarkably complete human being, Alexander Papaderis, if I have remembered the name right, who founded an institute for peace on the island of Crete, next to the mass graves of Germans and Cretans who fought each other bitterly in World War II. He wrote once about the vision that led him to do it. When I was a child, during the war, we were poor and lived in a remote village. One day on the road, I found the broken pieces of a mirror. A German motorcycle had been wrecked in that place. I kept one, the largest piece. By scratching it on a stone, I made it round. I began to play with it as a toy and became fascinated by the fact that I could reflect light into dark places where the sun would never shine, in deep holes and crevices and dark closets. It became a game for me to get light into the most inaccessible places I could find. As I became older, I grew to understand that this was a metaphor for what I might do with my life. I came to understand that I am not the light or the source of light, But light, truth, understanding, knowledge, light is there, and it will shine in many dark places if only I reflect it. I am a fragment of a mirror whose whole design and shape I do not know. Nevertheless, with what I have, I can reflect light into the dark places of the world and change some things in some people. Perhaps others may see and do likewise. Perhaps. If they can see.